Hello and welcome to the Morning Magazine for Thursday, April 22nd. I'm Sam Fuqua. Coming up, getting food to kids that need it. We'll hear about a home delivery service helping feed needy families. Another longtime Boulder small business is closing. Shannon Young visits Red Letter Books, the used bookstore on Pearl Street that's shutting down this week after over 30 years in business. At 8:30 this morning, Tish Buford sits down with Aurora City Councilman Juan Marcano to talk about the socioeconomic effects of the pandemic on Colorado's third largest city. And then at 9 o'clock, it is the fourth Thursday of the month, and that means time for the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Today, we'll hear from local author Mairead Case speaking about her new novel, Tiny, a modern-day reworking of the Greek tragedy Antigone. Diverse music on the Morning Sound Alternative at 9:30, all still ahead this morning on listener-supported community radio. Checking some headlines, 43 additional charges were filed Wednesday against the suspect in last month's mass shooting at King Soopers in South Boulder. Most of the new charges are for attempted murder of police officers and people inside the store. The suspect, Ahmad Al-Aliwi Alissa, was already charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder for the victims killed in the shooting. In addition to the new attempted murder charges, the Boulder District Attorney's Office also charged him with 10 counts of felony possession of a prohibited large-capacity magazine. The suspect is scheduled for a status conference on May 25th. By then, it's expected that a mental health assessment will be completed. Environmental groups suing to halt construction of the Windy Gap firming project in northern Colorado have agreed to drop their case in exchange for $15 million in water quality and habitat funding. Steve Miller reports.
The settlement agreement ends the litigation over the Colorado River Water Diversion and Reservoir Project. The $15 million settlement is to address concerns about the proposed project's water quality and ecological effects in Grand County. KNUC reports that the Windy Gap firming project includes the construction of Chimney Hollow Reservoir west of Loveland. The new reservoir would hold water transported across the Continental Divide from the series of reservoirs at the Colorado River's headwaters in Grand County. The stored water would be set aside for a group of growing Front Range cities. The settlement agreement signals the end of a years-long legal battle to build in some environmental protections to the Windy Gap firming project's construction and operation. Despite the additional funding, the representatives from the environmental coalition that sued to halt construction remained alarmed about the project's legal success and said the $15 million is a drop in the bucket. Gary Walkner, director of Save the Colorado, one of the environmental groups who initiated the lawsuit, feels that the settlement is not a win. He said the $15 million barely cushions the massive negative impacts caused by the Windy Gap firming project. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Colorado legislators passed a bill Wednesday that will make it easier for people exiting the prison system to obtain state-issued identification. Senate Bill 153 calls on the Department of Corrections to create a program through which offenders will be able to secure identification prior to release. It builds upon a pre-existing administrative rule that came into effect in 2013 and has since gained broad bipartisan support.
Upon exiting the prison system, people face so many hurdles as it is, and we wanted to make sure that having an ID isn't one of them.
That's Kyle Piccola with Healthier Colorado, an organization backing the measure. Piccola says having a state ID is crucial to accessing employment and housing and opening a bank account. He notes a quick transition to self-sufficiency is in the broader interests of society.
The first period of time after release is an extremely important time to make sure that somebody settled securely in the community. It's very important to be successful right then to prevent recidivism as well. And so if we can eliminate as many barriers as possible, then that's one way that we can prevent recidivism. And obtaining a state ID before you exit the prison system is one of those barriers that we're going to eliminate right off the bat.
Senate Bill 153 enjoyed ample bipartisan support, and Governor Jared Polis is expected to sign it into law. Cloudy today with light snow or rain possible and a high near 50 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with lows in the mid-30s. Continued partly cloudy Friday with highs in the mid-50s tomorrow. It's 9 minutes after 8 o'clock. This is KGNU. Well, KGNU's new news director, Shannon Young, continues to find her way around Boulder. She walked into Red Letter Books on Pearl Street for the first time yesterday, just in time for their closing. The venerable used bookstore is ending its over 30-year run because the building they're in is slated to be torn down and replaced with luxury condos. Shannon spoke with Red Letter owner Seth Rowland.
I am here with Seth Rowland, the owner of Red Letter Books on Pearl Street. And stepping into the store, people are putting books into boxes, and on the outside it says we're moving. What's going on?
So we're a bookstore that has been on Pearl Street for about 31 years, and we are unfortunately being asked to leave. They are developing the space. I think it's going to be condos and upscale dining. So yeah, this is not due to the pandemic or financial struggles or anything. It's due to development. And right now we don't have a space. We will continue to sell books in some capacity with the hope to relocate down the road somewhere else in Colorado. Not sure where that will be yet.
So most likely not in Boulder?
I would love to come back to Boulder. The community knows us here. We have people from all over the country that will come to us. So it's somewhat of a destination for bookstores. Unfortunately, you know, I'm also a bit of a realist and understand that pricing might prohibit that for rent and whatnot.
And when did you start to feel the pressure, price-wise, just rent for this space and in general of operating as a business in Boulder?
I would say about 5 years ago, our building sold. We had been operating with the same landlord for about 25 years. And that's when we started feeling the pressure. Our rent immediately went up. We were feeling the heat before the pandemic even hit. And this block had quite a bit of vacancies from the same gentleman who bought this building. He's working on half the block for his development.
Are there any other well-known landmark businesses that you know of that are also in the process of leaving or thinking about leaving?
We're kind of the last man standing, so to speak. There have been a lot of great stores on Pearl Street. I think it's stores like ours that made Pearl Street a destination for people. But Penny Lane, we're on the same block that Penny Lane used to be, which was a coffee shop, and they would have open mic poetry nights and, you know, people like Nirvana played there back in the 90s. There's even the Boulder Army Surplus store. There's Bart's. I know I'm forgetting a bunch, but it just left and right, we saw some of the old timers go from Pearl Street, and it's kind of been replaced with vanity boutiques and upscale dining.
And what does this bode for the character of Pearl Street, which is considered a destination for outsiders like me who are just getting to know the town?
There's a reason that people come to Pearl Street, and that reason is to see these independent businesses that are all doing their own thing. Eventually, I think that, you know, if it's nothing but condos and banks downtown, why come? You know, so that family from Omaha who's visiting Colorado for the summer, why go to Pearl Street when, you know, there's nothing to function for you? You know, the vibrancy of a block needs to be a mix that draws people to it. And I feel Boulder is losing that mix. I do think that there's a certain craftsmanship to selling used books. And I think that, again, Boulder is losing some of our craftsmen, or people, I should say.
Now, I just walking by on Pearl Street, I saw that this place was relocating. But I found out more about the story behind it because a customer sent me an email, forwarded your email, talking about why you were closing and when you were closing. What has been the reaction from some of your clientele?
You know, I mean, it's a little different now with the pandemic. So we would have customers that would come, you know, once a year during the summer, and we were always a spot that they could visit. And because of the pandemic, we've really not been able to say our goodbyes to some of those longtime out-of-towners. I mean, business was terrible during the pandemic here on Pearl Street. It was the worst we've ever seen in 31 years, but we were able to weather it. You know, that's the most community that we've felt in Boulder in quite some years, actually, was when they heard of the loss of the bookstore. So we're seeing a lot of old-time people we haven't seen in, you know, a couple years, to people that come in daily, you know, just coming in to give condolences. And you know, books find you in here. I think there's a soul to this store, and it'll be sad to see it go.
Seth Rowland is the owner of Red Letter Books. The bookstore is in its final days of operation at its location on Pearl Street. For KGNU, I'm Shannon Young.
8:15 at listener-supported community radio. April is a busy month for the YWCA in Boulder County. This month is when they celebrate Stand Against Racism to raise awareness about the negative impact of institutional and structural racism in our society. KGNU's Rosana Longo spoke with Karina Corral, manager of Community Engagement and Equity, about the theme this year.
Corral reflects on how racism is everywhere and how, being a first-gen Latina from a Mexican family, she has had the opportunity to observe how racism is everywhere.
Racism is everywhere, unfortunately, and my parents come from Mexico, so I am a first-generation Mexican student here, and, you know, growing up in Colorado, there's not a whole lot of diversity where I was from, so I think I was always more observant to it, just growing up in a household where it was so culturally different than my peers and the people that I'm friends with, that I went to school with. So it was something that I was always aware of, and I was always interested in how to make things better, how to make more people compassionate. So I did go to CU for international affairs. So I was always super interested in cultural studies and learning about different cultures and also history and politics. So I always knew that I wanted to work in some space where I could help, where I could contribute to programs that were working towards racial equity. So my junior year, I found the YWCA in Boulder, and they had a position to be a LAS advocate. So that is the Latina Achievement Support Program. So there I was able to mentor a group of high school Latina students in Boulder and just teach them lessons every week and just really give back to the community and be a mentor that they could relate to. So that was really impactful in kind of my first steps into helping out. And I would also just look for internships. I also had an internship with Generation Teach, where we, our focus was also on racial equity and education. So I taught middle schoolers in the summer, social studies and STEM experiments. So that was amazing. My passion has always been like racial equity, especially within the youth. So yeah, and after I graduated, I was able to get this amazing full-time position with the YWCA.
That was Karina Corral, Manager of Community Engagement and Equity at the YWCA of Boulder County, talking about an event scheduled for this afternoon, Thursday, April 22nd, from 5:30 to 6:30, to raise awareness that racism is a public health crisis in our communities. For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo in Boulder.
And again, that virtual webinar is from 5:30 to 6:30 today. It's free. You can find out more information and register at ywcaboulder.org. That's ywcaboulder.org. It's Earth Day, and for Earth Day, we have a new feature called H2O Radio. Regular Morning Magazine listeners know Jamie Sudler, who brings us the headlines Mondays and Wednesdays. He's also part of this ongoing series on water. Let's check out H2O Radio.
China tells Japan, if it's safe, drink it. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, the Japanese government announced that it would release more than 1 million tons of water into the sea from the Fukushima nuclear facility, which was damaged in a devastating earthquake and tsunami in 2011. The announcement was met with criticism from China, Taiwan, and South Korea.
Almost 200 tons of cooling water are pumped over the reactor cores each day to prevent more damage. The water becomes contaminated with radioactive chemicals and is treated and stored in tanks on site, but space is running low.
The plan is to begin releasing the water in 2 years and continue slowly over decades. Japanese officials have said the water will be treated further and diluted to meet World Health Organization standards, although it would not be able to remove one contaminant, tritium, a radioactive form of hydrogen.
A deputy Japanese prime minister said he thinks the water should have been released earlier and that it would be safe to drink.
In response, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry challenged the Japanese official to drink the treated water and said the ocean is not Japan's trash can. Japan countered by citing China's past history of pollution.
The U.S. government released a statement supporting the Japanese plan, stating it appears to be in line with accepted nuclear safety standards.
Sea levels are predicted to rise in the San Francisco Bay Area as much as 7 feet by the end of the century.
Some cities are turning to building more seawalls and raising levees, but in a new report, an environmental group says one of the best solutions is literally being thrown away, mud.
Right now, much of the bay is dredged to maintain shipping channels, and the mud is barged out to sea and dumped. But if left to accumulate, it would form shoreline marshes that are a natural buffer against rising waters.
Scientists with the San Francisco Estuary Institute argue these wetlands could be the perfect solution to protect the bay because they can grow vertically with the rising water levels. However, they'll need more mud to do that.
Unfortunately, the Bay Area has been losing sediment over time because rivers that would naturally transport the silt and sand are blocked by dams.
The good news? Most of the needed sediment can come from current dredging activities. The rest can come from relocating sediment trapped behind dams or using dirt from construction projects.
The authors say this natural infrastructure would cost less than seawalls and bring more benefits, such as providing habitat for aquatic life and migratory birds, as well as recreational opportunities for people.
Temperatures in cities can be up to 7 degrees higher than in outlying areas. In some poorer neighborhoods with less tree cover, the differences can be as much as 20 degrees during the day.
One solution that has been used for centuries is to paint roofs white to reflect light and heat.
But there are degrees of whiteness, and products currently on the market don't reflect all the sunshine. However, engineers at Purdue University have developed a new ultra-white paint that reflects 98% of sunlight.
The paint is able to cool surfaces by 8 degrees Fahrenheit under strong noon sun. The researchers say it could reduce the need for air conditioning, which would decrease the use of fossil fuels that contribute to global warming.
About every hour and a half, Louisiana loses, on average, coastal wetlands equal to the size of a football field, and New Orleans is one of the most vulnerable cities in the U.S. to climate change, not just because of hurricanes, but also sea level rise.
A pair of Tulane University students came up with a way to address the problem one bottle at a time. They thought discarded beer bottles could be blasted into sand and used to reinforce the state's eroding coastline.
New Orleans bars and restaurants produce tons of waste from glass bottles, and because the city doesn't offer curbside recycling, most of them end up in landfills.
So, as The Guardian reports, the seniors started collecting bottles in a backyard and launched a company called Glass Half Full.
Bottles are fed through a mill that turns them into tiny particles of sand. The finer grains can be used in sandbags to protect against flooding, and larger pieces can be used in flooring and stucco.
Glass Half Full has already been successful in reducing waste, and in their first year, over 650,000 pounds of glass were diverted from landfills. That's it for This Week in Water. We'll see you next time.
The Week in Water from H2O Radio. Support here on listener-supported KGNU, where it's 23 minutes after 8 o'clock. Colorado Food Cluster and Bondadosa is a free program funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's for anyone from 6 to 18 years of age. It supports student nutrition and enrichment. Youth receive a weekly box of 7 meals and 14 snacks delivered straight to the door. KGNU's Rosana Longo spoke with Maggie Brown from Bondadosa about why this is an issue of equity.
I myself was on free and reduced lunch at school my entire life. So for me especially, this makes a big difference in the lives of community members working 1 to 3 jobs, trying to balance childcare and making sure their students are getting their homework done and everything. And so for us to be able to provide these free meal boxes, it aligns with what the schools would normally provide, right? There are still pickup options for people to get breakfast and lunch, but if you don't have the transportation to get there, it doesn't help. So for us, we're delivering these boxes directly to the students so that they can have the nourishment that they need while they're learning in a very different environment or setting, providing some stability for the students and for the other family members to know that this basic need is covered and that they can then focus their energy on learning, or the guardians can then focus their energy on being out and finding work and finding opportunities to guarantee success for their family. It's pretty wild to me how many students are not able to receive some of the meal services just because they don't have the transportation. And especially as public transportation was so disrupted over this past year and continues to be disrupted, the delivery service has been crucial. We're grateful that we can do that because we as Bondadosa are a social venture company. We strongly believe in supporting our community and providing these opportunities. So we find it not only the right thing to do, but the most important thing to do to give people a way to earn income by serving their communities as well. So the same people who can receive these boxes can then also apply to work with us, become a delivery agent, a warehouse specialist, and earn some skills and earn some money to make a difference.
So what are the requirements for these young people to receive these boxes with food?
This is my favorite part because we've made it as easy as possible. We have a website, coloradofoodcluster.com. Anyone goes to that website within about 20-25 miles radius from downtown Denver, they can receive these boxes. The sign-up form takes about 2 minutes, and it will collect the parent or guardian's information for delivery, and it will collect the student information or youth and their date of birth. So as long as they're 18 years and younger, we can provide this service through the end of the school year for this style. And then, like I said, we'll have a summer program as well. So that's pretty exciting.
It is important because in the summer, when the sun is out and the days are longer, they are even more hungry.
I know, running around and playing or working, you know, for the students who are maybe 16, 17, 18, could be working jobs. And so again, to just have something guaranteed at home is really important. I'll also add that the form for registration does not require any kind of documentation or citizenship, and it doesn't require any kind of income verification. We have access through USDA waivers, US Department of Agriculture waivers, to provide this home delivery service. It's as if we are an at-risk after-school site. So we really have tried to make this as easy as possible and remove the barriers that really exist around accessing free resources for families who are in a hard situation. So we just want to make sure that kids get the food that they need. Another aspect of removing this transportation barrier in terms of access is the stigma that sometimes comes along with needing help, right? Like I remember, you know, when I would have to take things home from school, like there's a certain amount of bullying that still exists around requesting help or being in the level of poverty or having different situation than some of your peers. And so for us to be doing the home delivery for this service really takes away that stress or stigma from the student that they don't have to carry something home in front of their friends or classmates and be judged for that. So we've heard from, you know, some of our community members that that's been a really big piece too.
Why do you think it is important for those that are listening to us to request this service? Why do they deserve it?
That's a very good question. I mean, to me personally, food is a basic human right. It is our medicine. It is our first level of need to be able to survive. And not only to survive, you know, the day by day, but to properly nourish the body allows us to be more productive, allows us to be more engaged, allows us to really take the opportunities for success in the future. We know that when people are struggling with making ends meet and paying the bills, that they're also more likely to struggle with other things as well. Like maybe that's mental health, maybe that's healthcare for family member that they might be supporting. And so for us to take one layer off of that plate of worries is a really big deal. We want our community to be healthy and to be empowered and to know that they deserve the best and to know that they can accomplish whatever that they want, you know, when they have the right tools. It's a big deal for us.
Thank you, Maggie Brown with Bondadosa. For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo.
And if you're interested in getting more information or signing up your student for the Colorado Food Cluster, we have a link on our website. Go to kgnu.org/morningmag, and it'll be on the page for this morning's magazine. That's kgnu.org/morningmag.